You're listening to Idaho Matters. I'm Gemma Gaudette. The workplace has changed dramatically over the years, in particular these last 2 years during the pandemic. But I will guarantee that one thing hasn't changed, and that's probably dealing with difficult coworkers. In her new book, Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them, social psychologist Tessa West gives us scientific-based strategies on what to do. Tessa is joining us to talk more. Tessa, it's really nice to have you on the program.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So first off, what made you decide to write a book about this?
It's a great question. So I study how people interact, often in awkward social situations, like how to give feedback to someone who's your boss, how to negotiate and so forth. But what I found through the years is it doesn't matter what you do for a living or how long you've been working, whether that be, 2 months right out of college or 20 years, we never actually go to school for this sort of thing. We don't learn conflict management, low level issues like dealing with credit stealing and, someone taking over in a meeting or on a phone call. None of us really get educated on how to handle this stuff. But there's new research that just came out showing that's actually the number one reason why people leave jobs. In fact, the Great Resignation is not about compensation and working from home. It's about toxic workplace culture. So it behooves us to learn a couple of strategies for dealing with this kind of conflict. And so, that's my hope with the book, is that people will feel there are some things in here that they can actually do to improve their workplace.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you write in the book too about how stressful work situations, they don't stay at work. I mean, I think anyone listening right now, can probably think to a time, whether it's in the past or right now, where those work situations, I mean, they bleed into your personal life. It goes home with you. And I mean, how important is it for people to, to acknowledge that and then frankly, find tools to deal with it? Because as you said, I mean, that's many times I've thought like, well, should I leave this job? Should I do something else? Not based on, as you said, compensation, but like, can I deal with this individual any longer?
Yeah. So, when I was researching for this book, I was quite honestly shocked at how easy it was to find studies showing direct associations between workplace stress and everything ranging from heart disease, cancer, obesity, marital conflict, male impotence, and fights with teenagers. All of these things that we deal with at work directly affect our psychological health and our physical health. But we tend to only care about the really big, egregious things, these like very stressful but rare events that happen at work. But it's the low-level daily stuff that actually affects our health and well-being, because the human body is not equipped to handle low-level stress repeatedly over time. It's equipped to handle big stressors and bursts that happen infrequently. So I do think it's critical we learn these things. I also think our temptation, if we have a toxic workplace, is to leave the job and to go elsewhere. But there's not a lot of research that shows that some workplaces are sort of free of toxic people and other workplaces have a bunch of them. All workplaces have them. And it's better to learn how to handle these folks, because we don't have control over who we work with. You might move to a job that's great, but you don't have control over who your manager hires or who the new CEO is going to be. And, we can't control these relationships. And so we should figure out how to make them work early and often, instead of just sort of hoping for the best that we don't get toxic people at our next job.
You write about certain types of coworkers in the book. And I want to go through that first, because you also kind of give advice on how to deal with it. And this is, I think, what you're talking about, is that it's not these high level stressors, but kind of those low level stressors. So let's start. And you identify four types. So I want to start with what you call the kiss up, kiss down coworkers. So who is that? And what does that mean? And then what can you do if you run into this?
Yeah. So these are the people that are awful to everyone who's at the same level as them or beneath them, but they bring some skill to work. And so the boss tends to really like them. The challenge with these people is you can't just simply complain to your boss, because if you do, they either don't care because they value this person, or even worse, they accuse you of being jealous of this person because they have some skill set that you don't. And so our intuition of complaining and then feeling unheard and so forth tends to, you know, be pretty ineffective. A better thing that you want to do is before you even approach a boss, do a little bit of homework, form some allies outside of your immediate social network. You know, I like to go to people who are well connected, but aren't sort of personally invested in my own well-being. So they're not there just to make me feel better, but they are there to connect me with people who know my kiss up, kick down, or maybe worked with them in a previous life or on a previous team. And, you know, give me a bit of a reality check of how widespread the problem is. Then from there, you can document their behaviors and go as a group to your boss. So bosses tend to not care so much if you're the only one complaining, but if they think the problem is widespread and it can become a disease, you know, within the company or within a team, they're much more likely to care because they don't want that revolving door of talent. And when you do this, I would always open up with something about that kiss up, kick down, or that you know is a strength, because it shows you can perspective take. It shows you're not just being petty and jealous. You understand why they like this person, but you know they're problematic for the following reasons. And you're worried that if this problem doesn't get solved, there's going to be a revolving door of talent or disengagement at work because of it. But it does take a little bit of, you know, networking and doing some homework behind the scenes to get this one right.
So then the second one you call the credit stealer. And I have to say, I think a lot of people deal with this. So explain what this is and then what do you do?
So credit stealers are often people who pretend to be our friends, our confidants, sometimes even our bosses, and we share our best ideas with them. And then they, you know, go behind our back and they take credit for these things, or they often take credit for the hard work that we've done. So this can be a really frustrating experience. A lot of times we work in teams where it's not really clear who said what, you know, who exactly should be getting credit for certain things. So a lot of us walk away feeling, you know, miffed and shortchanged, like we didn't get credit for ideas somebody else did. So in these kinds of situations where it's really hard to figure out who did what, you need to have some clear structures in place going into these meetings where you document who said what and when, you make sure you echo the contributions of other people and so on and so forth. But if you do want to confront your credit stealer, instead of sort of opening with the problem, open instead with sharing a perspective on what happened. So often what I see when I research teams and credit granting is that almost everyone on a team thinks they did about 90% of the work and that 90% of the ideas came from them, but that possibly can't be the case. So there's probably a good chance there's a little bit of this kind of natural human bias going on with you as well. You need to share your perspective and ask them their perspective on what they think happened. Even if you don't believe them or you're pretty sure they stole your credit, allowing them to have voice and just to share their opinion can often kind of diffuse a situation and make it less threatening. When you then say, well, I said X and I feel like, you know, you kind of then took my idea, just to kind of, you know, get people on the same page and get them communicating. Also, bosses often like this because it looks like that you can just have an open and honest conversation without being defensive. You know, and then from there, you kind of do things like identify what different people have accomplished, you know, and then look out for some warning signs. Like teams full of like-minded people often actually suffer from this the most because they come up with the same ideas at the same time. So it's very often hard to know who said what.
All right. Number three is the bulldozer. Now you kind of describe that person as, you know, in meetings, they're the first person to talk, right? So, but go into more depth about what you mean about this, this person in the workplace and what you can do.
Yeah. So bulldozers, they tend to take over processes. And a lot of them have had positions of power in the past. And so they know who exactly they can go to behind the scenes to get what they want. So you find yourself kind of hitting a wall, not being able to get processes through, ending votes in an impasse because you have a bulldozer on your team. And I think kind of the dark truth of the bulldozer is that we often hand over power to these folks really early on in group decision-making because they volunteer to do things that nobody else wants to do. So almost every time I've encountered a bulldozer at work, it's someone who volunteered to, you know, organize all those resumes for a job search or write a computer program that allows us to do things more efficiently. So they hold this power early that we all handed to them. And then we get, you know, kind of mad that they have it, but they've made themselves invaluable to the team and we're relying on them to get ahead. And they know this and they know if they exert power early and they offer to do these jobs, it's impossible to get rid of them later. So the number one thing we can do is kind of early is not do this, divvy up responsibilities, you know, pretty evenly. And then also have things like, you know, turn taking rules in meetings and simple things like setting your Zoom setting so that the speaker doesn't take up the screen. You know, one thing we learned during this pandemic is that a bulldozer can talk, and they're the only person you see quite literally on your screen when they start talking over someone. Everyone else's camera, their little photo disappears, and it's very easy to kind of forget who they interrupted. And so changing little settings and things like that can also help a lot. And then making sure that we echo the contributions of less powerful people who are on a team that could easily be bulldozed.
And then your final one is the micromanager. Ay, ay, ay. This brings back some PTSD from a former job. can you talk about this individual?
Yeah, I mean, so micromanagement is actually the most common management strategy out there. Most people are micromanagers. And the reason why is because they're super conscientious, so they want to feel busy, but we rarely actually get any leadership training, or we don't learn how to manage. Right? So we're promoted because we are good at our old job, not because we learned how to manage. So we micromanage because it makes us feel useful and our boss isn't telling us otherwise. So I feel a little bit bad for these folks because they're often well-intended, but they're anxious and they don't have great strategies. And so this is what they do. And I think our tendencies are either to kind of hide from them. And I've quite literally hid under a desk to avoid a micromanager before. But during the pandemic, that's impossible because they can just email us all the time and text us all the time. There's no work hours anymore, right? You know, to confront this person, you don't want to lead with micromanagement as the problem. You want to lead with the consequence of that problem, which is you're not aligned on your goals. You and your manager are not aligned on what you should be doing and when, and probably not aligned on where exactly you see yourself going in this job. Because if you keep doing, you know, working for a micromanager, you're not going to go anywhere. So I'd have that conversation about high-level goals. Where do you see me going? Well, here's where I see myself going. Now let's have some mutually agreed upon expectations of what I need to do and when. And then here's the part people don't like to hear, but it does work. Have short, frequent meetings with your micromanager that just provide a very structured interaction. So instead of them just kind of treating you like you're on their beck and call, they know that every 4 days they're going to see you for 15 minutes. And that actually helps prevent them from micromanaging. It reduces their own anxiety and gives them structure. And then these meetings can be super short and just action oriented. Here's what I did. Here's what I still need to do moving on. And people feel much better once that structure is in place.
So before we wrap up, I mean, you can also run into these types of individuals just as coworkers. I mean, for example, with the micromanager, I mean, I used to work with someone who was a coworker who watched the clock for everyone, right?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. And then would report to the boss if somebody, you know, showed up late to work or went home a couple of minutes early.
Yeah, they're a bit of a tattletale-y bulldozer micromanager, right? They are self-appointed. Yeah. I like to call these folks hall monitors. So we all know who these people were in high school, and they just haven't really graduated from high school. They're just hall monitoring at work. Yeah, these folks can be very tough because no one tends to trust them and they want to disengage from them. But I think, you know, they tend to also have some skills. They tend to be very organized. And so you can learn how to harness those skills for the greater good of the team. The best thing you can do is approach these people and don't avoid, but redirect. So the same thing that you would do with a teenager who's out of control, you don't try to stomp out the behavior, but you just redirect it. And so folks like that, you can actually have them police people who are bulldozers, and they do a great job at it.
Oh,
I see that you really want, you know, X, Y, and Z to happen. You want everyone to follow rules. We're really, you know, struggling with Tom. He takes over meetings and he interrupts all the new people. Would you mind the next time he does that stepping in and saying, we'd really love to hear from, you know, Stacy, the new team member? And they tend to get really excited that they can then use their skills for something that then makes them feel included on the team. So I'm all about that redirection with folks like that.
I tell you, it really is like raising kids in a way.
Yeah. I mean, no one graduates from high school. I firmly believe that. So.
Exactly. Not emotionally, right? Jess, it was so great talking. It was so great talking with you. Thank you for this advice. I think it will be very useful for a lot of people.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. We've been talking with social psychologist Tessa West about her new book, Jerks at Work, Toxic Coworkers and What to Do About Them. It is available now, and you can always find more about Tessa's work and research in the Wall Street Journal. She is a regular contributor there. I want to thank all of you for being a part of Idaho Matters as well. Our producer is Samantha Wright and Frankie Barnhill. And I'm Gemma Gaudette. See you back here tomorrow.